ready to rumble, roll on to the end. Running for that line to score a win.
That's a new All Blacks song, actually, by Jeremy Cooper. And for people interested in hearing more of it, Jeremy Cooper, songster.co.nz, which is his website, and also on the website a video of the song and the words, both of which can be downloaded for free. All Blacks are in Australia, a step closer to setting the longest winning streak in Test history. By the way, thank you, Jeremy Cooper, for the song. And today the Herald has rugby legend Michael Jones declaring the team possibly the greatest New Zealand side to play the game. A tired-looking Wallabies team, apparently, gentlemen, rehearsing at Suncorp Stadium.
It's very good of them.
What do you think?
Well, this is fantastic.
I'm not sure what I'm asking you what you think about it.
Well, the question you prompted us with on our notes was, do we care? And I think,
right,
of course we care.
Because
every generation wants to know that there was something special about their generation. It's lovely to know that the current All Blacks team represents sort of golden era of New Zealand rugby. And so 30, 40 years from now, we're sitting there in our sweaters, our cardigans and slippers and smoking our pipes, and we tell the young'uns, you think you know rugby these days, you should have seen it back when I were a lad. You know, we had Richie McCaw playing, and those were the good old days. That's when rugby was proper rugby. And we like that. I mean, in Britain, we still hark back to 1966 in England winning the FA Cup. I mean, I know it's all we've got. You know, you don't get many footballing successes in Britain, so you cling on to what you have. It's 46 years ago, but we still dream of Bobby Charlton, Jeff Hurston, Bobby Moore. That's we know that was our golden age, and the thought of having one right now is fantastic, isn't it? This will be the iconic All Blacks team.
I know. I wonder if we're in danger of taking them for granted. They're so good, win so often. I don't know if I didn't feel the same thrill I used to feel when we beat the Springboks in South Africa. That was like Everest climbed every time we used to beat them, wasn't it? Now, I know that probably the fact we play so often now has something to do with that having changed. But beating Australia in Sydney at Suncorp Stadium, is it Suncorp? Is it in Sydney? I think it is. That's not something we've been able to take for granted in recent years either, because Australia's beaten us more often than we've beaten them. So
Brisbane,
that's right.
I didn't mean to interrupt and disturb your flow of thought.
Yes, well, it wasn't much of a thought, really. But,
you know, rugby excellence in New Zealand, though, you know, you say is it different. I mean, it is coming increasingly at a price. We discussed on the panel not so long ago that, you know, 22%, I think it was, of rugby finances is now propped up by pokies money. It ain't the old days.
No, it's not.
Well, this is, you know,
and they're playing for different reasons from what they used to play for in the old days when they smelled of liniment and sweat in the dressing room.
Well, if we go far enough back, back in the old days when the gentlemen played, and obviously they played for the love of the game, and that was all it was, of course. But now people play for money. It's a job. You know, they're going to go out and put the jersey on to make their living. It's an earning for them. It's a very nice one. It's a very prestigious one. But it is a job.
And does it mean as much, though, than it did, as much as it did in the days, you know, when they trooped back to their farms, their humble farms, with the Macrocarpa windbreaks and immediately began to resume milking the cows?
Well, I think it means just as much to the current players, to be honest. It's a different thing, and it's not as amateur, and it's not as give your life, and it's not about the money. It is clearly about the money, but still, this seems a pretty special team. And I have to say, after 30 years of watching the All Blacks, one of my favourite teams was the 1995 All Black team. They came second, but I thought they were a wonderful team. And so, and this team seems, well, they've gone beyond that in achievement. I think it still matters to the players. We're more cynical because there's so much sport. Isn't there? I mean, so much professional sport. That's the problem. That's what's diluted the brand. God, I hate that word, brand. But and then that, again, is part of the problem. That's how sport is spoken about these days, as a brand.
And Richard, I think you're right. You are taking it for granted. You just assume, the All Blacks, they're going to win again. I'm English. I come from a country that invented most of the major sports in the world and were rubbish at most of them. It's terrible.
Yes, but we always assumed the All Blacks were going to win.
Yes.
There's been that assumption of All Black invincibility with the odd hiccup through the decade.
Okay, some of the hiccups got rather long, I'll grant you, but it's kind of coming true again, isn't
there
it?
There hasn't been the same assumption about English soccer.
Well, not for a very long time.
I have to say, the All Blacks started the professional era very badly. you know, other teams had jumped ahead of us. England were much better. I mean, they won the World Cup, what, 2003? We did not get our act together. I think the amateur era, obviously, we were the dominant force. But when the game turned professional, that changed everything. All the teams got in the gym. It sort of levelled the playing field. Oh, they had more money. And so now we should remember that. We weren't very good, actually.
Oh, we had a series of bad breaks and poisonings, Richard.
And we were not very good, apart from that 95 team. They were wonderful, but...
I saw England lose to France at Eden Park last year. All I can tell you, it was as though they'd never seen a rugby ball before.
They were a dreadful team.
My wife's American, so she was kind of at this point not totally influenced either way. But 10 minutes into the match, she turned to me and said, "I'll be cheering for France." And I thought, yeah, I kind of don't blame
you. You must have taken that hard, Steve.
I couldn't really blame her, to be honest. I was just waiting for it to be over.
That English team, they did not concentrate on the game, did they?
No, they'd certainly never met each other before. They'd probably never seen a rugby ball before. It was horrible.
And they went to Queenstown, another fatal error.
Yes. Had they replaced the rugby ball with dwarves, it might have been a different matter.
What goes on tour stays on tour. Now...
not if you're English, mate. No, you're in the sun before
you've team.
You're in the sun before you've got your undies back on.
That's something else that's changed. Thank you, Richard. Richard, a poem from Richard shortly. Steve McCabe, what's on your mind?
Well, it's a slightly mundane one this time, Jim. But you know, words matter, don't they? I mean, it's what we do here. We it's all about the words. And there's one word that I've been noticing lately. It's been getting abused so badly. It's the word iconic. And I don't know why, but it's been really grating with me that lately I've noticed that this word that used to mean something really big, being iconic was a big deal. It meant that you were representative of your field or you stood out within your field. It was a big deal to be iconic. And suddenly I noticed, and it's been fascinating to watch in the last couple of years, this word iconic, everything that's remotely remarkable has become iconic. And I started really seeing the rot was setting in. About 6 months ago, I saw something in the paper referring to Auckland's iconic home show. Is it really? And then about 6 weeks ago, and our little interlude earlier reminded me of this, was I actually saw a reference in a newspaper from Britain to the Korean singer Psy and his iconic Gangnam Style dance. I mean, that's iconic. Yeah. I mean, it's moderately famous. And it just suddenly occurred to me that all we're doing now is we're devaluing our language. Everything now goes up to 11. It's like the word awesome.
Oh, everything goes up to 11, guys. Yeah. Yes, but...
But awesome's kind of benign compared to iconic. I agree. Icon is something special, isn't it? Something elevated.
It should mean something. And suddenly like I say, Gangnam Style's iconic apparently now.
But I mean,
I weep.
The abuse of iconic is now almost iconic itself.
Yeah. I mean, but
it's been year after year after year after
endemic.
Year of iconic.
But in the last two or three years, it's suddenly taken off. Out of nowhere, it's like somebody said, "Oh, okay, June the 7th, time to do it." Right, iconic, and they flicked a switch, and suddenly now it's everywhere. Everything and his dog is iconic.
What can you say instead of iconic? This is the difficulty, I think, for people writing at speed. I suppose you can say emblematic, but it doesn't seem to connote the same degree of awesomeness.
But if we're going with, say, the home show, is the home show really emblematic of Auckland? Sky Tower is, Rangitoto Island is, but an exhibition, I'm thinking not quite so much. It's famous.
If something's iconic, you shouldn't actually have to say it's iconic because it is, you know, it's unstated.
Yeah, it's one of those things like, you know, these disappointing English comedians in the 80s say, "Look at me, I'm crazy." And I'm thinking, yeah, if you have to point out that you are, then you're not
really,
right.
You're quite right, Richard, because the word iconic is used to try and sell people the idea that this might be iconic.
Advertising has co-opted the word, and that's the problem. No disrespect to advertising people who have to write their copy, and all writing takes effort and sweat.
Why can't we go back to really good? Now, that was a phrase that's neglected.
Yeah, the really good Auckland home show.
Yeah, the really good Auckland home show.
Well, the Auckland home show, and we will know if it's really good by its track record. No one needs to say it's iconic.
And I know we sound awfully grumpy.
The really good All Black Colin Meads, you see? The redundant, you know.
The awesomely iconic.
The
Auckland
awesomely
home
iconic
show.
Oh, stop it. Colin Meads.
Yeah, we sound horribly curmudgeonly here, don't we? It's like, as I remember when gay used to mean happy and blithe and carefree, and I want the word back. It's not like that. I mean, words change. We know they do, but it's just happened so abruptly and so drastically.
Okay, but if we're going to use iconic every day, as a common and garden adjective, then we need something to replace things that are truly iconic.
Exactly.
Or else they must forever remain unstated.
Exactly, because we're just constantly devaluing the words.
Nouns and verbs, stick to them, as Ernest Hemingway said.
And now, a man who rivals the great Hemingway, but in a different medium, our poet, Mr. Richard Langston. What have you got for
us?
Well,
I'll apologise in advance for the adjectives in this poem. I generally try and keep them out.
Iconic's not in there, is it?
No.
Oh, good. That's all right, then.
No. I'm saving that for my advertising career. This poem's... The last poem I'll read on the show from my book, Things Lay in Pieces, Jim. I think I must have read just about all 50 of them on the show, so I'll thank you in advance for that, for your forbearance.
It's a very fine volume.
Thank you. And this poem is called The Woman Who Loves Bars, and it's a celebration of friendship and enjoying yourself in the moment.
Good.
Her mother gave her the last florin in the pocket of her fur coat. Told her to spend it at the Ritz. The woman who loves bars is 7. Silk and oysters the finest cut. Madame Clicquot in the Antipodes. Flaming russet hair, blue eyes. She is every light of the heart burning. She is rain and carousing on Tuesday night. Those jazz blue eyes, smoky tunes. Penniless, the woman who loves bars would stand this round and the next. She waves the waiter over as she leans in to visit every corner of your happiness.
Nicely put, Richard Langston.
That's what good friends are for, having a wine and sharing your joys and tribulations.
Where did that come from? I mean...
It is based on a woman I know who is a marvellous, I think the word, bon vivant. And she knows how to enjoy life. And every time we go out, I'm from Dunedin, I'm always checking my wallet and making sure there is some money in it. She just gets the credit card out, goes to the top shelf and says, Madame Clicquot. I mean, Clicquot, Veuve Clicquot. And she just knows how to live. And, yeah, you need those sort of people in your life, don't you?
You do.
And that's a poem to her. I won't name her because she'd be tremendously embarrassed.
And a good cheerful poem for the Labour weekend.
Yes.
Richard Langston, Steve McCabe. Speaking of which, police say they'll be watching motorists closely if you're driving somewhere now in an effort to reduce the road toll, currently 8 deaths higher than this time last year. Does that surprise you after all the intolerance of any speed over the limit with the new speed cameras in place? And they'll proliferate, apparently, in the endless campaigns. Do you find it odd that the road toll is up?
A little bit, yeah. There's... One thing that struck me since I've been driving the roads of New Zealand is once you're off, out of the towns and off the motorways, the roads here are good, but they are narrow. And that's going to cause the problems. You know, the road we're talking about in particular here, the stretch of Highway 2, is a windy, twisty road with... I mean, they've now lowered it to 90 kilometres an hour. I believe the signs call it a... Is it an enhanced safety speed, they call it on the signs down there? I forget. But there's no shoulders on the sides of the roads. Your options are suddenly dramatically reduced when you've got nowhere to go. So if there's something happening ahead of you, if somebody coming towards you suddenly pulls out onto your side, you have no choices.
I think visibility has decreased in that respect over the years too, because there are more SUVs you can't see through. There's more traffic on the road, heavy traffic that you cannot see. In the old days, I think it was a lot easier for people to see what was up ahead.
Well, there was nothing in front of you, was there, half the time?
Well, that's true, in terms of population. But,
yeah.
Okay, Richard?
I love the way we are reminded, but only really at holiday time, the police make a special effort to remind us that cars are lethal things. And it's kind of macabre that we say, you know, the fact that Easter, it was nil, no one died on the roads. It was like some sort of victory. But, of course, road safety is an all-year thing. It's not just at the holiday break. And the I know it, you can't tell human beings every day, keep your speed down, we will be fining you, we don't want you to die, because the message wouldn't work. But it's kind of sad, isn't it, that we only get reminded at holiday weekend, drive carefully because you will die if you don't.
Yeah, it's also worth bearing in mind that speed seems to be the one thing that we're focusing on here. Keep your speed down. I mean, it's very, very easy to quantify, and you can measure it quite nicely. and you can limit it. But speed isn't the only thing that kills. And we do have odd speed limit progressions up here. Drive up, say, to Warkworth and beyond, up State Highway 1, and you've got a nice two-lane each-way motorway with 100 km/h speed limit. Go through the tunnels past Puhoy, you've got a winding, hilly, almost mountainous one-lane each-way road. Speed limit's still 100 km/h. There's something wrong there. I mean, I know there are certain criteria it hits, and therefore it qualifies as a 100 km/h road. But really, should you be going at the same speed there? It's not just the speed that's going to get you.
Can't you judge that as you drive?
Well, apparently not. Certainly north of Warkworth, when you go through the Dome Valley, people clearly can't.
Yeah, okay. Road safety commentator, publisher of the Dog and Lemon Guide, Clive Matthew Wilson, joining the panel. Clive, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Well, this is right up your alley in terms of a conversation because...
Yes, you handed it to me on a plate. Okay, has anybody listening to the show now ever been angry, distracted, or tired? Is there anybody?
Yes, exactly. put your hand up now. Or has failed to keep left, or has ever been sleepy, or has ever crossed the centre line, or whatever.
Okay, so let's go to the cut to the chase here. You know, if you listen to the police or many of the road safety advocates' argument, you know, about behaving properly and keeping your speed down and being alert, I'm in complete agreement, and who could disagree with them? The problem is that they're assuming that people can act consistently for 24 hours a day, and that's simply not the case, never been the case. There will always be tired old people. There will always be nurses coming home from a late shift. There will always be teenagers who feel they're 10 foot tall and bulletproof. Whether it turns into tragedy is largely in the hands of the government. For example, in the previously deadly stretches of Waikato Road that now have centre lane barriers, the fatalities have virtually dropped away to nothing. And I think that speaks for itself. You know, people blame the driver, and I blame the driver also, by the way, for being a bloody idiot, drifting over into someone else's lane, and now there's two dead people. This is shocking. It's unforgivable. But the fact is, it didn't need to turn into a tragedy. Idiotic behaviour has been around as long as there is cars. But idiocy doesn't have to turn into tragedy, and whether or not it turns into tragedy is directly in the hands of the government. And for those who wonder why we don't have centre lanes down every road in New Zealand, main road in New Zealand, there's two very, very good reasons. One is that the Transport Act, the legislation is aimed at traffic flow. In other words, the more cars we can fit through a given space, that's what the roading engineers have to aim for. And second thing, because the trucking lobby lobbies heavily against anything that slows down trucks. And when you get winding roads, it slows the trucks right down if they have to sort of negotiate difficult spots.
Okay,
so... there's a lot more dead people that don't need to be dead.
All right, so your point, and we've heard it before, and fair enough that you should mention it again because I know you believe in it so strongly, about centre barriers. Other points. I mean, we slow down, do we, for the long weekend, and then we creep back up to 109, 110 k's the rest of the time and we start to have accidents again? Or is there a correlation?
Well, there is and there isn't. People, you know, the police, because of the heavy anti-speeding campaigns, I've been noticing a dramatic decrease in the average speed on Auckland motorways. The problem is that the people, we don't need to slow down the average driver because the average driver is very rarely actually involved in a fatal collision. You have the same people that you would expect. You know, I've been many, many times I've been going, wow, the traffic's really behaving today. And then some, you know, sorry to be stereotypical, but the hoon with the baseball cap on backwards in a lowered car goes past me at 130 kilometres. You know, I mean, you don't need to slow down the average driver. What you need to do is to slow down that small minority of drivers that tend to cause the accidents.
Okay. Has anyone else noticed this? Because it's funny you should mention it, Clive. I wondered about it this morning driving in on the Northwestern Motorway. I thought, I think people are now generally driving slower, and I wonder if that is as a result of the television campaigns. Because you don't
It's not the campaigns, it's the enforcement. It's like the lock on my garden shed. It's stopped 100% of Ponsonby yuppies breaking in. Unfortunately, Ponsonby yuppies aren't the people that break into garden sheds. And in exactly the same way, the police campaign has done a brilliant job of stopping the people least likely to have accidents. And if you look at the fatalities over the last few months, they tend to be people, you know, the farm workers down south who were drunk in a four-wheel drive. I mean, they tend to be the sort of people that you know, aren't slowing down and are never going to slow down, and who don't see that there's a problem, and who see life as just something that happens to them. Whether or not they take you and I out this weekend depends largely on the road and also the car that we're driving. And that's where the emphasis needs to be. Also, and I'll just add the little thing here, that there is absolutely no question that the life-saving potential of simply having daytime running lights, or if you don't have them, headlights on in your car over the weekend. The European studies, I mean, it's staggering. You know, just about one of the biggest road safety improvements you can possibly get is to have daytime running lights on your car, not spotlights, things that can be seen but don't dazzle. And, you know, you can reduce daytime accidents by 20%. That's a huge, that's more than, you know, most other road safety strategies combined.
Clive Matthew Wilson, thank you, from Dog and Lemon, 7 minutes to five. The thing now, though, is that even if it's questionable, cracking down on what you might call safe speed infringements, ones, you know, that you get pinged for, but, you know, you're not going that fast, it becomes truth, doesn't it, because of the campaigns? Because even if you're a doubter, a cynic about this, you start to doubt your doubts and you come to regard travelling at 110 k's an hour as deeply criminal. Have you noticed a shift in your own perception of these matters?
Well, I've been hit by a couple of speeding cameras over the last couple of years. And so, yeah, whether I think it's effective or not to reduce my speed, I keep my speed down because I can't afford to keep getting the speeding type of tickets. So it's modified my behaviour.
Not on your salary.
Good Lord, no.
My behaviour's been modified because I'm a bit of an old granddad driver and my mind tends to drift off whenever I go past water and I'm looking at water. So my wife told me she wasn't travelling with me some years ago, and so now I don't drive at all, hardly.
Hitchhikers, beware of a man named Richard Langston. Richard Langston on the panel.
Easily distracted, Jim.
Steve McCabe at 6 minutes to five. Fire chiefs failed to cope with the February 22nd earthquake response, according to a new report which criticised them for being disorganised, out of the loop, failing to support their firefighters who were battling to save lives. I'm quoting from the Fairfax coverage. For 6 hours after the quake, no frontline operation staff heard from either of the three executive officers on duty that day, and the management failures meant key heavy equipment wasn't mobilised, communications broke down, firefighters weren't fed or watered, and operations officers on site were left to organise everything, apparently. So now we're told this management team has gone, and presumably it's a new improved regime in place. We have no reason to doubt that. But it got us thinking, aren't we always told this? Let's move on from the firefighters. Institutional failure of one kind or another seems to be the new disease. Yes, we're perennially told such and such events were unfortunate, very unfortunate, but new protocols and systems mean that this kind of unfortunate episode won't be repeated in future. We've seen what you could call systemic failure many times recently with ACC and the Ministry of Social Development and the Air Force, and the list goes on. Today we present an alternative way of fronting the media in these situations, which we offer to all spin doctor departments within large organisations. The honest explanation. John Johnson from the Damage Control Division of the Ministry of Human Management. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Jim.
John, things went badly wrong for you when all those files got released and then we found your senior management team had invested money in a brothel to fund the annual conference in Queenstown. And then there was the purchase of the new computer software, which it turned out was controlled directly by Chinese hackers. What was the problem exactly?
Well, Jim, the problem exactly was we didn't know what we were doing.
Right, John. These are the men and women who caused the problem who are now gone?
No, Jim. We caused all the problems, but we managed to get some people to fall on their swords.
Okay, but I still don't understand what the problem was. I think we can't fathom how an organisation comes to be in this state.
No, we can't either. What we all did, or rather didn't do, it seems pretty stupid.
It does. Was it your systems and protocols? Was it systemic?
Well, yes, it was systemic because we had a system, but it wasn't a very good one.
Why don't you think you had a very good one?
Same old story. People promoted beyond their competence. People made to work too hard. People given bonuses that made them think more about dollars than people. And people listening to outside consultants with the management theory of the week, if you will.
That's quite a list.
Oh, and general brain fades as well. I'm not quite sure where they come from.
Okay, but some of the outcomes seem baffling, John. I mean, if you applied this level of decision-making in your own life, you know, in your own home.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this, Jim. Yeah, you're right. The roof would have collapsed years ago, or I'd be minus three fingers after chopping the carrots for dinner.
Yes. So that's it? No other insights you can offer? The same thing won't happen again, will it?
No, definitely not. Next time it'll be a new thing. It'll be worse too next time because nothing's changed.
There'll be an inquiry though.
Yeah. We'll hire someone who used to kick around the place and needs his pension topped up. He'll make useful recommendations and then we won't listen to them.
I don't think we need to hear that, John. I'd prefer you told us that now these people who've resigned are gone, it'll all be all right again.
Oh, okay. All right, Jim. Now that these people are gone, it'll be all right again.
Thanks, John. It's good to hear that. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
John.
Please tell me that's not true.
That was Jeremy Elwood, actually. Jeremy Elwood playing John Johnson from the Ministry of Human Management's Damage Control Department. But is there a point being made here, actually?
Yeah, there is. We do run a good inquiry. It's just a shame we have to have so many of them. And, I'm dumbfounded, really. Dumbfounded, Jim.
It's not often you're lost for words, Richard.
No, it isn't.
Do you think we're getting to the bottom of things in our inquiries in general? And, gosh, I mean, there are so many. There are so many organisations and not just government departments, Lord knows, that we could name. Do you think it is a bit of a modern disease?
Well, yeah, we're forever fighting the last battle, aren't we? One of the phrases, I don't think I've ever heard it before when you came to New Zealand, but I love it, the concept of the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. Seems to be what we do. We seem to wait. I mean, how many cliches have we trot out here? Closing the stable door after the horse has bolted, you name it. That's what we always do. Everything's hindsight. Everything's reactive. We wait till a mess occurs, and then we fix it. But then the mess has already occurred. We don't seem to be, although I hate the word, it's a loathsome word, proactive.
How often do you think we get to the bottom of things?
We keep digging, don't we? And keep digging deeper. Not very often, I think, is the answer.
We'd like to think we learn from our mistakes, don't we? I mean, that's the basis we operate on, that we will learn from our mistakes. But
then we make more new and more exciting mistakes.
History would suggest otherwise. I wonder, you know, we get rid of the management failed, the fire management failed in Christchurch. We get rid of them because they were incompetent. And is there any guarantee that the new management won't be incompetent? I mean, given that they were faced with such a task of such magnitude.
Yeah, one of the core things going on here, right in the very middle of that discussion, was the fact that we were talking about people promoted beyond their competence, and that happens all the time in every organisation. It's known as the Peter Principle. You promote people to one level above what they're actually able to do. And we do this all the time.
Is it just the excitement of the 24-hour news cycle and, you know, the greater scrutiny now, or does this seem to be happening more often?
No, it's human nature. We always, anytime something bad happens, something must be done. We need to point fingers.
All right. Well, we won't point any more at the moment. We'll just wish you a lovely weekend, a lovely restful weekend. You've just had school holidays, now you've got a long weekend. It's a lovely life as a teacher.
Oh, we deserve it, mate. We deserve it.
Steve McCabe. Richard, thank you for the poem. Very nice to have you on the panel.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Have a lovely weekend, everybody. Drive safely. We are back on Tuesday, and Checkpoint follows.